Stories from the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices, more on how the pandemic is affecting education in the U.S., and from Romance to Robins, why so weekend is going to the birds. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us this morning. Up first in our program, West Dayton Stories is our series exploring the strength and resilience of Dayton's African American community. It comes from the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WISO, which highlights the stories of those whose voices often go unheard. Here's Center producer Jocelyn Robinson with more.
Young people are raising their voices in the political debate, and we need to hear them. Community producer Jalen Yates shares his ideas on the importance of voting, especially locally.
Post-election. A lot of people feel a relief that Trump is out of office, but there's a portion of the population that feels nothing will improve. From being experienced in voter registration, I've talked to people of all ages who feel the same. I find myself somewhere in the middle. A lot of my family members and friends kept asking me, "Are you going to vote? Who are you voting for?" Of course, I was voting. From being raised in a household where voting wasn't essential, I honestly responded, "I don't know as far as presidential, but for local, I'm voting for whoever's agenda aligns with West Dayton community." Normally, they'll say I'm not voting, but I encourage them to vote local anyways. There's a generational disconnect, but I honestly feel people are tired of putting faith into a system that hasn't done much for our communities unless black issues fit white agendas. Even though we've seen black electors, I believe people will soon seek another way to elect leaders, hopefully in a more conventional way or younger electees. When it came time to vote, I did what I said I would. I voted locally and ignored the presidential. The older I get, the more I feel the election process is a propaganda campaign to continue to sway minds in a certain direction. Some older generations would love to debate the importance of voting, but the younger generation feels it's time for more forward-thinking solutions. If it hasn't worked in our favor, then it must be broken. Reminds me of the industrial age, how that generation until this day still hasn't fully accepted the information age. Some neglect it, and some stay in the old ways, but some have jumped in and started to work with younger generations to understand new technology and advance it. Hopefully, voting changes for the better, too. For West Dayton Stories, I'm Jalen Yates.
Jalen is also a musician and entrepreneur. We'll have more opinion and commentary from our community producers in the weeks to come, so keep listening. Our theme music is by Dayton's own Mariah J. I'm Project Director Jocelyn Robinson.
West Dayton Stories is supported by Citywide Development Corporation. For more information on the project, visit our website, wyso.org. Daytonian Larry Crowe has conducted over 1,500 interviews of African Americans for the PBS History Makers Project. Here's an excerpt of his talk with WISO's Basim Blunt about three prominent local black historians he thinks everyone should know.
Just for our listeners that may not know, why was there a need to create a Negro History Week?
Here's a story from John Henry Clark, another great historian of ours from New York. Clark, as a young boy in Columbus, Georgia, asked the lawyer that he worked for. He cleaned out the lawyer's office. He thought the lawyer, since he was a very smart white man, liberal white man, would know something. He had a library of books. He said, "Do you have any books on Negro history?" And he said the lawyer took his glasses off and looked him square in the eye, and he tried to let him down easy. He said, "John, I'm sorry to tell you, but the Negro has no history."
Yeah.
I mean, that's cold, isn't it?
It's cold.
The Negro has no history.
And he believed that. I mean, he's a lawyer, an educated man.
Yeah. Well, John Henry Clark didn't believe it. Mm-hmm. He looked at him and said, well, there's something that I've got to find the missing pages.
Let's talk about Dayton now. You're from Dayton. Are you born and raised in Dayton, Larry Crowe?
Yes, I was. I was born in Dayton in 1949. I ended up going to Fairview for the rest of the high school term and then to Wright State after I graduated from Fairview. I think at the beginning I was the only black student that wasn't from Shawn Acres Children's Home.
It was integrated then, right? Or
yeah, me and the students from Shawn Acres were the integrators of Fairview.
You brought out the names of three black African-American Daytonians that have carried the mantle. Who do you want to start with first?
The first one I heard of was Mr. Robert Rice. He was born around 1915, I guess. He taught history at Dunbar. I heard him speak in 1973. Well, I never heard anyone speak specifically about the black history of Dayton before. I think a lot of us take our local history for granted. Like, we think, like, what could have ever happened here, you know? Robert Rice, his father, Lucius Rice, was one of the first black police officers on the force. The story of his father's demise, being shot by an escapee from a Mississippi chain gang in 1936 over on College Street. In fact, my mother says we used to live in the house where it happened.
There's a small placard in the Caroline Park Historical Museum to Robert Rice's dad, Dayton's first black police officer, and there's a little history and a photo at Caroline Park. Tell us about Margaret Peters.
Margaret Peters. She was a school teacher, educator. She had gone to Weaver School and to Roosevelt and to the University of Dayton. And she started teaching in 68. In 1970, she put together a book for Johnson Publishing Company called The Ebony Book of Black Achievement. That had nationwide distribution, but it had illustrations of great black leaders of the past, African and African-American. And I think it's Mansa Musa on the cover, drawn on the cover.
Mansa Musa, is he still known as the wealthiest human that ever lived? I mean, we talk about Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos, but he's known as the wealthiest person that ever lived.
And lived in there during the 1400s and Mali, you know. In medieval Mali Empire, he was the king of Mali, I guess you'd say.
Now, her signature book that I saw when I moved to Dayton, what's it called?
It's called Dayton's African American Heritage. I found one at the library book sale, the first edition, which has Mac Ross on the cover. He was a Dayton Tuskegee Airman, standing in front of his plane. And the second edition has Dayton Contemporary Dance Company on the cover.
You can Google her, Margaret Peters. You can go to the library and get the book out and share it with your family if you really want to get a deep understanding of Dayton's black history.
Yeah, she's been very important to the study of black history in Dayton.
So Robert Rice and Margaret Peters, I guess we could say, are trained historians who did the scholarly research through academia and through graduate work at college. Let's get to our third historian that you want to share with our audience and tell us about this person.
Oh, yeah. This is Charles Moseley Austin. He's a year younger than Ms. Peters, or would be if he was still alive. He was born in 1937 and died in 2016. He worked for the Dayton Black Press, you know, I'm not a doctor, but I think he had bipolar disorder. And that doesn't account for his interest, but it accounts for his focus, because he could focus. He was known for getting in fights with librarians, receptionists. I mean, not physical fights, but he, though I was...
Because he lived at the library. I mean, that's where you would find him.
He was obsessive about it, black history in Dayton.
I was honored to meet him when I moved here. And someone said, have you met Charles Austin? And I said, no, who is he? He's a historian. And I said, well, where can I find him? You know, at Wright State, at UD, or whatever. Like, well, go down to the library, and you'll see him.
He's in the tradition of J.A. Rogers and John G. Jackson, John Henry Clark, and others. So, but Charles Austin went back into the public library, the depths of the old newspapers, and uncovered just stuff that would knock your socks off.
Yeah.
About Dayton history. The information is just incredible. You know, he goes back to the founding of Dayton in 1796 and goes forward. With any time a black person is mentioned in any publication that's in the library, he records that.
We talked about Margaret Peters actually publishing through Johnson Publication. Charles Austin photocopied and used a typewriter, but it had a I made this at home kind of feel to it. That's how diligent and focused he was.
He never states anything without attribution. And he makes an, and he always, he qualifies the information in his books by saying, "I, to best of my knowledge, according to this oldest source I've been able to find."
Right.
If there's an older source, then you find it, you know. According to what I've been able to find, this is what it says. He doesn't think that everything he says is right. He's not getting it from revelation or anything. He's getting it from a source. But he had, like, information that you just would not find anywhere else. He had black people gathering at 3rd and Main to take advantage of tickets to expatriate to Haiti. You know,
wow.
That's a chapter in African-American history we don't know anything about. But
right.
The Haitian government actually sent 6,000 tickets to black Americans. And 25 black people met at the corner of 3rd and Main in 1825 to take advantage of 25 tickets to go to Haiti. And they left town. It's in a Dayton newspaper.
I'm so glad I got to meet him, because you could see him walking downtown in different neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
Walking with a little leather bag over his shoulders with his books in them to sell. Then went from the written word, he started recording mm-hmm. cassettes where he would just record his voice on a tape recorder telling oral histories of Dayton. And he would package those cassettes and type the labels out on a typewriter and photocopy, like, images of Dunbar, and then shrink wrap the cassette in plastic. And he would, like, carry all this in his bag. And so he would engage you in a great conversation, chain smoking cigarettes, and then he'd pull out these cassettes or these self-published books, and, you know, at the RTA, at the bus hub.
So, I was lucky, like you by seeing him, I was lucky enough to meet him. I met him at Kwanzaa.
Everyone
this is what we call... calling Kwanzaa Kuji Chagalia, self-determination.
Kuji Chagalia, yes.
To define yourself, name yourself, and speak for yourself instead of being defined and spoken for by others.
How am I doing? Hey, hey. Now I know a gal named Sadie Green.
I'm going to end this with a challenge. You talk about local history, and not only in Dayton, but these small towns in Ohio. I'm going to test you because I'm a DJ. You're a historian. So I love music.
Okay.
All right. So what?
I love music too. So
okay.
I'm not a DJ. I can say so. We're about equal then. We have different.
Right. I stun people with this little known fact of black history. But do you remember the Mills Brothers?
But it's understood that everything I do, I sure do good. How am I doing? Hey, hey. Tweet, 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 twat, twow.
Yeah. Yeah, they were my father's favorite group.
They're your dad's favorite group? What town of Ohio do they hail from?
All right, let's see if the clock ticking here. Anyway, now, Piqua, of course. Piqua.
Oh, you got me. All right.
Piqua Way, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
You've earned
Piqua,
your keep,
Ohio.
Sir. Thank you for sharing with us, Larry Crow, the history of Robert Rice, Margaret Peters, and Charles Moseley Austin, three black Daytonians that we should all be proud of.
All right. Thank you, Brother Bossy.
Hey, bye-bye.
How we doing? Hey, hey. Oh, gee, oh, baby, oh, show. How we doing? Hey, hey. Tweet, 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 what, wow. How we doing? Tweet, 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 what, wow. How we doing? Oh, oh, gee, baby, oh, show. Happy-dee-dee-low. Happy-dee-dee-low. Oh, oh, me. Do-ba-ba-dee-dee-doo-dee. How we doing? Da-da-da-da-da-da.
You know, having second chances can be pretty important. Here at WISO, we've given you the gift of infinite second chances to listen to our homegrown music shows on demand. Now you can listen to programs you may have missed for 2 weeks after the initial airing. How cool is that? WISO on demand. To give it a try, go to wiso.org.
Hi, this is Karen Bledsoe, Director of Business Support at WISO. When a business supports this station, we acknowledge that support with 15-second announcements about the business. Many of our clients use those announcements to share information that is in the public interest. Do you have an important message to share? Let's talk. My contact information is on the WISO website.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. When the pandemic sent children home from school nearly 1 year ago, it largely thrust education on the backs of parents. A new national survey from Public Agenda finds that only about one-third of parents think they can handle the challenge, but it also finds that teachers and parents are in broad agreement that in-person teaching during COVID is dangerous. Carter Barrett of Side Effects Public Media reports.
Ashley McCollum is a 35-year-old mom who lives in Chicago Heights, Illinois. When the pandemic hit in full force last year, McCollum had to quit her job as a home health aide to stay home with her 5-year-old son and 11-year-old daughter. And that took a toll.
We had to basically leave from where we were staying to move in with a family member because, you know, with me not working, I couldn't pay rent.
Adjusting to homeschooling wasn't easy, and McCollum had to learn to be a teacher.
And when they stopped school, like, they didn't let us know where, you know, they left off teaching the kids anything. So when he started, like, in kindergarten, he was lost.
Just this week, McCollum got an email from her daughter's school announcing that she could return to an in-person hybrid schedule in March. But McCollum says she was disappointed with the lack of information about safety procedures from the school.
How I feel about the situation, I'm not going to let them go back.
The new national survey from Public Agenda, a nonpartisan research and public engagement organization, shows that a majority of teachers and parents across the country are reluctant to jump back into in-person schooling. Here's David Schleifer, director of research at Public Agenda.
There's really a lot of agreement between teachers and parents on really most of the things that we asked about.
In-person school is far better for students, both for their educational and social development. But teachers and parents are equally divided on whether or not it's worth the risk.
Both teachers and parents are really struggling with what is right during this, you know, really challenging year. It's not like teachers and parents are like lined up on opposite sides of this issue.
New research from the Centers for Disease Control shows COVID-19 spread in schools is minimal if precautions are taken, like mask wearing, small class sizes, and physical distancing.
We're hoping to get them back as soon as possible.
38-year-old mom Lindsay Stroot in Southern Illinois is ready.
Especially knowing that it seemed like this doesn't really affect children as much. I mean, all kinds of things were put in place in the school. Yeah, I felt pretty comfortable sending them as long as your kids are not symptomatic.
Around 37 states have prioritized teachers in the vaccine rollout's first phase, a key step for the economy so parents can return to work. Andrew Simmons is a high school teacher in San Rafael, California. He says that's a good first step.
I think we would at least feel more comfortable that we weren't jeopardizing our own health.
But Simmons is skeptical the hybrid model, half in school, half remote, will undo months of social isolation or educational inequities that have been magnified by the pandemic. Andres Perez agrees.
Parents have every right to feel upset about the state of their student schooling. That is valid.
His community in southern San Diego County has been hit hard by the pandemic. He's a high school English and history teacher and says schools should be assisting families in ways outside of education.
And we also need to, of course, listen to our families and our students about what they need.
One positive note, the Public Agenda survey found that most teachers and parents think communities value teachers more now than they did before the pandemic. For America Amplified, I'm Carter Barrett of Side Effects Public Media.
And as the COVID vaccine rollout continues, Midwesterners have a lot of questions about distribution plans and the vaccine itself. One state is getting help from a surprising place, public libraries. Darian Benson reports.
Noble County is mostly rural and sits in the northeast corner of Indiana. When local officials looked for vaccination sites, they saw a place that was centrally located and accessible. Library Director Sandy Petrie knew the perfect fit.
They're able to drive right up to the door and, you know, they've got wheelchairs and walkers downstairs, but they can, just the way we're set up, they're able to drop off, especially the elderly, like literally 3 feet from the door. So it has been a fantastic situation for us.
The library's first floor conference rooms have been converted to storage, vaccination, and waiting rooms. Petrie says the changes have not altered the operations of the library. Indiana Library Federation Director Lucinda Nord says libraries have evolved to help communities throughout the pandemic. In the fall, they started working with the state to see what they could do once vaccines were available.
That includes helping disseminate information about the vaccine, about the safety of the vaccine. You know, residents have lots of questions about what it is it safe, how does it work, who's eligible.
Indiana's vaccine plan includes an age-based rollout. Nord says some older residents might be uncomfortable registering for a vaccine online. Others might not have a computer. Manla Moyo is with AARP Indiana and says members are at high risk for severe COVID complications. The organization has worked hard to provide information on the virus and the vaccine, but Moyo welcomes help from others.
AARP won't be able to solve the needs for everybody. We won't be able to reach everybody. But if we're all sort of singing from the same hymnal and reaching out to our members with similar information and similar resources, then the impact will be felt.
Nord says libraries are often one of the most trusted public institutions in a community, and that can help with people who are reluctant to get a vaccine.
And so we feel our job as those trusted professionals, as a trusted institution, is to disseminate fact-based information and to do outreach appropriately, because it's the library worker who has a relationship with, you know, the residents in their community.
In many rural communities, broadband internet access can be spotty or non-existent. Indiana Department of Health Chief Medical Officer Dr. Lindsay Weaver says libraries play an important role in addressing those equity issues.
We recognize that libraries are often the only way to access the internet because so many Hoosiers live in an area with limited internet access or cannot afford it. This provides support not only to Hoosiers, but to our local health departments.
The Carroll County Health Department is small. To prevent being overwhelmed, it sends residents to the library for vaccination help over the phone.
And so they just send them over here, and it takes, you know, about 10 minutes, and we find them a spot and get them registered.
That's Delphi Library Director Portia Capron. She says staffers print and mail out the confirmations.
When their appointment comes up, they're fully registered. They can just walk in. All their paperwork is done. They walk in and get their shot, and they're ready to go.
The Mooresville Library created an express station computer that takes users directly to the vaccine registration. Director Diane Herkamp says the goal is to streamline the process.
You're looking at the demographics of mature age folks that might not be able to click three or four different, you know, addresses or URLs to get to that point. And we want to avoid frustration. It's already frustrating enough to maneuver on the internet, so we're trying to eliminate that.
Herkamp says community outreach is just part of being a library.
This is what libraries do. When there's a situation where we can come in and provide assistance, that's what we're here for, is to provide assistance, to give information.
From Side Effects Public Media, I'm Darian Benson.
Find more reporting from Side Effects Public Media on our website at wyso.org. Up next on WISO Weekend, we've got Bird Note, and Bill Felker has this week's Poor Will's Almanac.
This is Bird Note. People have many ways to express love. But humans aren't the only ones with romantic gestures. Many birds have their own ways of showing affection. One way is allopreening, where a bird uses its bill to groom a partner, twirling each individual feather in its beak. In more than 500 species, allopreening helps cement pair bonds and reduces the chances of separation, but does not prevent infidelity. In some other species, birds present their partners with gifts like moss or sticks. Among ravens, this can elicit a bout of allopreening or playing with a present together. A female Arabian babbler might reciprocate with a gift of her own. Or just cut to the chase and lead her suitor to a rendezvous spot in the shrubbery. Male whiskered terns gather food for their mates, but things don't always go as planned. Some females have been known to exploit courtship feeding by luring males into giving up fish meant for another female and then evading copulation. If you're struggling to find the right romantic gesture this Valentine's Day, you could copy these birds and offer some moss or dead fish, or perhaps stick to a box of chocolates. For Bird Note, I'm Wen Fei Tong.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of late winter. It's the first week of the Great Groundhog Moon, named, of course, in honor of the Great Groundhog, and it's the fourth week of the Sun in Aquarius. Today I was getting ready to leave home when the first robin of the year landed in the ginkgo tree outside my window. I glanced down to get my coat, and when I looked up, there were two robins in the ginkgo, then three. As I was walking to the car, four more robins flew in front of me. After supper, a friend called. She'd seen a whole flock of redbreasts gorging themselves on the fruit of the crabapple trees in front of her house. And so the plot thickens as I realize I'm not alone, and that my robins are not the only robins. And what I see happening here is happening actually throughout the country. I see just a fragment of the world in my neighborhood, but if I see robins here, I know there are tens of thousands more moving along flyways just above the trees. The elusive movement of spring suddenly becomes accessible in my small and insignificant place, breaks through my winter stagnation, opens my eyes to more than just birds in the bushes. I take the part for the whole. I can actually see spring in front of me. Instead of being cloistered by gray skies and the cold, I imagine myself in the center of a vast migration that sweeps the whole continent, freeing me from the prison of winter, portending and predicting everything, from daffodils to tulips to iris, even lilies. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the first week of early spring. In the meantime, watch for robins and ride with their migration. They'll take you home to summer.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
Poor Will's Almanac is presented by Five Rivers Metro Parks, fostering physical and mental health through outdoor activities.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, your source for public service journalism and music discovery. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning. Now, on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb. This week on our show, it's not drinks, it's the culture of drinking. We've got a story about a very special whiskey that money couldn't buy. We talk about what really happens at last call in bars. We get into the meaning of mezcal and what it means to love drinking, even if you don't drink. All that and more on The Splendid Table.
this morning at 11 on 91.3 WYSO.